Okay, let me find my mouse here. And we're off on another Tuesday afternoon in America with Cancel the Cabal on Shake and Wake Radio. Also on PSN Radio and APGN Radio and SoFlo Radio. Thanks to Annie and all of the other station owners. I am Stephen Roberts. This is another Tuesday with Cancel the Cabal. How fitting, how fitting for a name of a show when, these people invented the cancel culture. So they should be canceled themselves, as far as I'm concerned. I don't want to kill any of them. And I mentioned that from the beginning, 9.5 years ago, coming up on 10 in February, 10 years I've been doing this. Didn't want to say kill anybody because they threaten you with extortion or threaten you with jail time if you say something about kill or murder or whatever the case is, you know. But canceling their canceling them is pretty much okay as far as I'm concerned. They don't have any problems canceling us. Gotta get my readers on. And just all of a sudden, haven't spoken much all day long. I start speaking and I get a sore throat. Or I get a little frog in my throat. I don't know what the case is. Just like Roger, I think. I don't know. The Scientific Outlook by Bertrand Russell. One of the great, wonderful, loving people of the progressive left, I'm assuming. They just want the good for us. That's all it is. They don't mean no harm. I'll go back one paragraph to remind myself and everybody else what went on last Tuesday. Jones. It starts off with Jones, but I'm not. Oh, okay. Just Mr. Jones. Like Mr. and Mrs. Jones. I had my spot, but then I lost it. If we assume for a moment the truth of the account which physics gives, we shall explain what you call seeing Jones in some such terms as the following. Little packets of light, called light quanta, shoot out from the sun, and some of these reach the region where there are atoms of a certain kind composing Jones's face and hands and clothes. These atoms do not themselves exist, but are merely a compendious way of alluding to possible occurrences. Some of the light quanta, when they reach Jones's atoms, upset their internal economy. This causes him to become sunburnt and to manufacture vitamin D. Others are reflected, and of those that are reflected, some enter your eye. They there cause a complicated disturbance of the rods and cones, which in turn send a current along the optic nerve. When this current reaches the brain, it produces an event. The event which it produces is that which you call seeing Jones. As is evident from this account, the connection of seeing Jones with Jones in the as a remote roundabout casual connection. Jones himself, meanwhile, remains wrapped in mystery. He may be thinking about his debtor or about how his investments have gone to pieces. Yeah, 1931. I think he's probably thinking about both. Where he's going to get dinner and where he's going to get investments. Or about the umbrella he lost. These thoughts are Jones's. But these are not what you see. To say that you see Jones is no more correct than it would be if a ball bounced off the wall in your garden and hit you. To say that the wall had hit you, indeed. The two cases are closely analogous. We do not, therefore, ever see what we think we see. Is there any reason to think that what we think we see exists? Although we do not see it, science has always prided itself on being empirical and believing only what could be verified. Now you can verify the occurrences in yourself when you call seeing Jones, but you cannot verify Jones himself. You may hear sounds when you call Jones speaking to you. You may feel sensations of touch which you call Jones bumping into you. If he not lately had a bath, you might also have olfactory sensations of which you suppose him to be the source. If you have been impressed by his argument, you may address him as if we were at the other end of the telephone and say, "Are you there?" And you may subsequently hear the words, "Yes, you idiot, can't you see me?" But if you regard these as affording evidence that he is there, you have missed the point of the argument. The point is that Jones has a convenient hypothesis by means of which certain of your own sensations can be collected into a bundle. But what really makes them belong together is not their common hypothetical origin, but certain resemblances and casual affinities which they have to each other. These remain, if in their common origin, is mythical. When you see a man in the cinema, you know that he does not exist when he is off the stage. Though you suppose that there was an original who did exist continuously. But why should you make this supposition? Why should not Jones be like the man you see in the cinema? I gotta stop here for a second and pontificate for a minute. There's been a lot of things going around Rosa Corey, maybe. She was with NASA, or I don't know who it was that has been telling everybody for the last 20 some odd years. I think she just passed away last year or something, but supposedly there is going to be a faking of a alien invasion coming up here next, couple of years. Some say by 2024, there's other dates next year or something, but I don't know. I know that they have fantastic holographic technology. That I do know. Everybody can see them videos out there on the internet. I'm not going to be the one to claim that I know what's going to go on, but who knows? We just need to keep that in mind. But he will be powerless to disprove it, since he cannot give you any experience of what he is doing when you do not experience him. Is there any way of proving that there are occurrences other than those that you yourself experience? This is a question of some emotional interest, but the theoretical physicist of the present day would consider it unimportant. My formulae my formulae, he would say, are concerned to proving to provide causal laws connecting my sensations. In the statement of these causal laws, I may employ hypothetical entities, but the question whether these entities are more than hypothetical is... Odiose? O-T-I-O-S-E. Never seen that word. Otis? I don't know. Since it lies outside the sphere of possible verification. At a pinch, he may admit to other physicists. He may admit that other physicists exist, since he wishes to use their results. And having admitted physicists, he may be led to politeness to admit students of other sciences. He may, in fact, form an argument by analogy to prove that just as his body is concerned with his thoughts, so bodies closely resemble his own are probably also connected with thoughts. It may be questioned how much strength there is in this argument, but even if it be admitted, it does not allow us to conclude that the sun and the stars exist, or indeed any lifeless matter. We are, in fact, led to the position of Berkeley, according to which only thoughts exist. Berkeley saved the universe and the permeance of bodies by regarding them as God's thoughts. But this was only a wish fulfillment, not logical thinking. However, he was at once a bishop and an Irishman, he thought not to be hard to on him. The fact is that science started with a large amount of what Santayana calls animal faith, which is, in fact, thought dominated by the principle of the conditioned reflex. Are the sound levels okay? It was this animal faith that enabled physicists to believe in a world of matter. Gradually, they have turned traitor, like men who, from studying the history of kings, have become republicans. The physicists of our day no longer believe in matter. Really. That in itself, however, would be no great loss, providing we could still have a large and varied external world. But unfortunately, they have not supplied us with any reason for believing in a non-material external world. All right, thank you, Annie. The problem is not essentially one of the physicist, but for the logician. It is, in essence, a simple one. Namely, are circumstances ever such as to enable us, from a set of known events, to infer that some other event has occurred? Has occurred, is occurring, or will occur? Question mark. Or, if we cannot make such an inference with certainty, can we ever make it with any high degree of probability? Or, at any rate, with a probability greater than a half? If the answer to this question is in the affirmative, we may be justified in believing, as we all do, in fact, believe in the occurrence of events which we have not personally experienced. If the answer is in the negative, we can never be justified in our belief. Logicians have hardly ever considered this question in its naked simplicity, and I do not know of any clear answer to it. Until an answer is forthcoming, one way or another, the question must remain an open one, and our faith in the external world must be merely animal faith. Number 3, the abstractness of physics. Even following that the sun, the stars, and the material worldly generally are not a fragment of our imagination, or a set of convenient coefficients in our equations. What can be said about them is extraordinarily abstract. What can be said about them is extraordinarily abstract. Much more so than appears from the language employed by physicists when they attempt to be intelligible. The space and time that they deal with are not the same and time of our experience. The orbits of the planets do not resemble the pictorial ellipses which we can draw in charts of the solar system, except in certain quite abstract properties. It is possible that the relation of contiguity, which occurs in our experience, may be extended to the bodies of the physical world. But other relations known in experience are not themselves known to exist in the physical world. The most that can be known, and that only of the most hopeful view, is that there are certain relations in the physical world which share certain abstract logical characteristics with the relations that we know. The characteristics they share are those that can be expressed mathematically, not those that distinguish them imaginatively from other relations. Take, for example, what there is in common between a gramophone record. That's an odd description. That's the disc that you turn by hand. The first record player, gramophone record, and the music that it plays, the two share certain structural properties which can be expressed in abstract terms, but they do not share any properties that are obvious to the senses. In virtue to their structural similarity, that one can cause the other. Similarly, a physical world sharing the structure of our sensible world can cause it, even though it may resemble it in nothing else, nothing except structure. At best, therefore, we can only know concerning the physical world such properties as the gramophone record and the music have in common, not such as distinguish them from one another. Ordinary language is totally unsuited for expressing what physics really asserts, since the words of everyday life are not sufficiently abstract. Only mathematics and mathematical logic can say as little as the physicist means to say. As soon as he translates his symbols into words, he inevitably says something much too concrete and gives his readers a cheerful expression of something imaginable and intelligible, which is much more pleasant and everyday than what he is trying to convey. Many people have a passionate hatred for abstraction, chiefly, I think, because it's intellectual difficulty. But as they do not wish to give this reason, they invent all sorts of others that sound grand. They say that all reality is concrete, and that in making abstractions, we are leaving out the essential. They say that all abstraction is falsification, and that as soon as they have left out any aspect of something actual, you have exposed yourself to the risk of fallacy in arguing from its remaining aspects alone. Those who argue in the way are in fact concerned with matters quite other than those that concern science. From the aesthetic point of view, for example, abstraction is likely to be wholly misleading. The music may be beautiful, while the gramophone record is aesthetically null from the point of view of imaginative vision, such as an epic poet may desire in writing the history of the creation. The abstract knowledge offered by physics is not satisfying. He wants to know what God saw when he looked upon the world and saw that it was good. He cannot be satisfied with formulae giving the abstract logical properties of the relations among the different parts of what God said. But scientific thought is different from this. It is essentially power thought and the sort of thought that it is to say whose purpose, conscious or unconscious, is to give power to its possessor. Now, power is a casual concept, and to obtain power over any given material, one needed only understand the casual laws of which it is subject. This is an essential abstract matter, and the more irrelevant details we can omit from our purview, the more powerful our thought will become. The same sort of thing can be illustrated in the economic sphere. The cultivator, who knows every corner of his farm, has a concrete knowledge of wheat and makes very little money. The railway which carries his wheat views it in a slightly more abstract way and makes rather more money. The stock exchange manipulator, who holds it only in his purely abstract aspect of something which may go up or down, is, in his way, as remote from concrete reality as the physicist. And he, of all those concerned in the economic sphere, makes the most money and has the most power. So it is with science, through the power which the man of science seeks is more remote and impersonal than that which is sought to be on the stock exchange. The extreme abstractness of modern physics makes it difficult to understand, but gives to those who can understand it a grasp of the world as a whole, a sense of its structure and mechanism, which no less abstract apparatus could possibly supply. The power of using abstractness and the essence of intellect, in which every increase in abstraction, the intellectual triumphs of science are enhanced. A lot of gobbledygook nonsense there, in my opinion. Chapter 4, Scientific Metaphysics. It is a curious fact that just when the man in street has begun to believe thoroughly in science, the man in the laboratory has begun to lose his faith. When I was young, most physicists entertained not the slightest doubt that the laws of physics give us real information about the motion of bodies, and that the physical world does really consist of the sort of entities that appear in the physicist equations. The philosophers, it is true, threw doubt upon this view, and have done so ever since the time of Berkeley. But since their criticism never attached itself to any point in the detailed procedure of science, it could be ignored by science, and was in fact ignored. Nowadays, matters are quite different. The revolutionary ideas of the philosophy of physics have come from the physicists themselves and are the outcome and careful experiments. The new philosophy of physics is humble and stammering, where the old philosophy was proud and dictatorial. It is, I suppose, natural that every man should fill the vacuum left by the disappearance of belief in physical laws as best he may. and that he should use for this purpose any odds and ends of enfolded belief, which had previously no room to expand. When the robustness of the Catholic faith decayed at the time of the Renaissance, it tended to be replaced by astrology and necromancy. And in like manner, we must expect the decay of the scientific faith to lead to a recrudescence of pre-scientific superstitions. I'm going to take my break right here and say, just before I do put a song in, I'm assuming, well, some people are going to take it as a good thing and some people are going to take it as a bad thing. Not meaning the audience here, but people in general. I think it was Saturday or Sunday. There was an article that had been circulated. I don't remember the publication, but it was that 400 churches in Texas are going to leave the United Methodist wing or faith, whatever you want to call it. They're going to leave the United Methodist for their stance on gay marriage. And you know, it's quite a large number, 400. That's just in Texas alone. It's either a good thing or a bad thing, depending on how you look at it. So I'll be back in about 4.5 minutes, everyone.
Thank you.
Okay, welcome back after the first break there. I don't really know how many churches there were in Texas that had the Methodist faith, but they're losing, what that article says, over 400, or more than 400. So that's probably going to be a pretty big hit for the Methodist denomination. In Texas, anyways, it's going to be a big hit. Well, now the Methodists in Texas, they can go full on progressive now. That they can just go full on progressive, and oh boy, oh, I thought I missed marking my spot, but I did. I got it. Yeah, they can just go full on progressive, gay marriage and everything, pedophilia, whatever they want. They can just do it now. So long as we do not inquire too closely what the scientist really means, he seems to be presenting us with a more and more imposing edifice of knowledge. This is especially the case in astronomy. The Milky Way, as everyone knows, consists of all of the stars in our neighborhood. Light travels at 186,000 miles in a second. The distance that it travels in a year is known as the light year. The distance of the nearest star is about 4 light years. The distance of the furthest stars in the Milky Way is about 220,000 light years. Telescopes reveal about 2 million systems of stars, each analogous. I have trouble with that word. I've seen the word before. I just have trouble with it for some reason. Analogous to the Milky Way. Some at distances of over 100 million light years. The universe is thus of a considerable size. But it is not supposed to be infinite. It is supposed that if you travel long enough in a straight line, you would ultimately return to your starting point, like a ship going around the world. There is, however, one reason to think that the universe is continually growing bigger, like a soap bubble while it is being blown. An eminent astronomer, Arthur Haas, suggests that the universe at some not infinite remote epoch had a radius of 1200 million light years, but that its radius is doubled. Every 1400 million years, that is, within a time shorter even than the age of many minerals, not to speak of, I gotta see if I missed a page. Yeah, you're welcome, Melissa. Nope, I didn't. And I guess that's Sarah also. You're welcome, too. Arthur Haas, suggests that the universe at some not infinite remote epoch had a radius of 1,200 million light years, but that its radius is doubled. Every 1400 million years. Why can't he just say 1.4 billion years? 1400 million years, that is, within a time shorter even than the age of many minerals, not to speak of astronomical estimates of the age of the sun. Nature, February 7th, 1931. This sounds quite impressive, but the scientists themselves are by no means persuaded that there is any objective reality about the large numbers in which they deal. I do not mean by this that they think laws they are enunciating untrue. I mean rather that these laws are capable of an interpretation which turns the abyss of astronomical space into mere auxiliary concepts, which are useful in the calculations by means of which we connect the real occurrence with another. Something, it would seem, as if astronomers consider that the only real occurrences in which they are concerned are the observations of astronomers. I guess that kind of makes a little bit of sense. I'm going to mark this spot and write this page down, because I want to ask somebody about it. I'm going to ask a science geek I know, a couple of them actually, what he thinks this means. Or they. Whoever wishes to know how and why scientific faith is decaying cannot do better than read Eddington's Gifford lectures entitled The Nature of the Physical World. He would learn that physics is divided into three departments. The first contains all the laws of classical physics, such as the conservation of energy and the momentum and the law of gravitation. All these, according to Professor Eddington, boil down to nothing but conventions as to measurement. True, the laws they state are universal, but so is the law that there are 3 feet in a yard, which, according to him, is just as informative concerning the course of nature. The second department of physics is concerned with large aggregates and the laws of chance. Here we do not attempt to prove that such and such an event is impossible, but only that it is widely improbable. The third department of physics, which is the most modern, is the quantum theory, and this is the most disturbing of all, since it seems to show that perhaps the laws of causality, in which science is hitherto implicitly believed, cannot be applied to the doings of individual electrons. I shall say in a few words about each of these three matters in turn, to begin with classical physics. Newton's law of gravitation, as everyone knows, was somewhat modified by Einstein, and the modification was experimentally confirmed. But if Eddington's view is right, this experimental confirmation does not have the significance that one would naturally attribute to it. After considering three possible views as to what the law of gravitation asserts about the motion of the Earth around the Sun, Eddington plumps for a fourth, to the effect that the Earth goes anyhow it likes. That is to say, the law of gravitation tells us absolutely nothing about the way the Earth moves. He admits that this view is paradoxical, but he says the key to the paradox is that we ourselves are conventions, and the kind of thing that attracts our interest are much more concerned that we realize in any account we give on how the objects of the physical world are behaving. And so an object which, viewed through our frame of conventions, may seem to be behaving in a very special and remarkable way, viewed according to another set of conventions, may be doing nothing to excite particular comment. I must confess that I find this view a very difficult one. Respect for Eddington prevents me from saying that it is untrue, but there are various points in his argument which I have difficulty in following. Of course, all of the practical consequences which we deduce from an abstract theory, as for example that we shall perceive daylight in certain times and not at certain other times, lie outside the scheme of official physics, which never reaches our sensations at all. I cannot be suspect, however, that official physics is just a little bit too official in Eddington's hands, and that it will not be possible to allow it a little more significance than it has in its interpretation. However that may be, it is an important sign of the times that one of the leading exponents of scientific theory should advance so modest an opinion. Good grief. I've already gone through 93 pages already. I just looked down. Now, oh, I lost my spot, of course. I come now to the statistical part of physics, which is concerned with the study of large aggregates. Large aggregates behave almost exactly as they were supposed to do before the quantum theory was invented, so that in regard to them, the older physics is very nearly right. There is, however, one supremely important law which is only statistical. That is the second law of thermodynamics. It states, roughly speaking, that the world is growing continuously more disorderly. Eddington illustrates it by what happens when you shuffle a pack of cards. The pack of cards comes from the makers with the cards arranged in a proper order. After you have shuffled them, this order is lost, and it is in highest degree improbable that it will ever be restored by subsequent shuffling. It is in this sort of thing that makes the difference between past and future. In the rest of rhetorical physics, we are dealing with processes that are reversible. That is to say, where the laws of physics show that it is possible for a material system to pass from state A at one time to state B at another, the opposite transition will be equally possible according to these same laws. But where the second law of thermodynamics comes in is, this is not the case. Professor Eddington enunciates the law as follows. Whenever anything happens that cannot be undone, it is always reducible to the introduction of a random element analogous to that introducing by shuffling. This law, unlike most of the laws of physics, is concerned only with probabilities. To take our previous illustration, is it, of course, possible that you shuffle a pack of cards long enough, the cards may happen to get into the right order by chance? This is very unlikely, but it is far less unlikely than the orderly arrangement of many millions of molecules by chance. Professor Eddington gives the following illustration. Suppose a vessel divided into two equal parts by a partition, and suppose that one part there is air, while in the other there is a vacuum. Then the door in the partition is open, and the air spreads itself evenly. Well, thank you. Spreads itself evenly through the whole vessel. It might happen by chance that at some future time, the molecules of air, in the course of their random movements, would all find themselves again in the partition in which they originally were. This is not possible. It is only improbable. But it is very improbable if I let my fingers wander idly over the keys of a typewriter. It might happen that I may screed, that my screed made an intelligible sentence. If an army of monkeys were strumming on typewriters, they might write all the books in the British Museum. I think that's the 100 monkey theory on typewriters, put 100 monkeys in front of typewriters, and they would eventually write out, what is it, War and Peace or something like that? I'm not sure how the story goes. The chance of their doing is so decidedly more favorable than the chance of the molecules returning to one half of the vessel. There are an immense number of illustrations of the same kind of thing. For example, if you drop one drop of ink into a glass of clear water, it will gradually diffuse itself into the glass. It might happen by chance that it would afterwards collect itself again into a drop. But we should certainly regard it as a miracle if this happened. When a hot body and a cold body were put in contact, we all know that the hot body cools and the cold body gets warm until the two reach the same temperature. But this also is only a law of probability. It might happen that a kettle filled with water put on the fire would freeze instant. Wait, it would freeze instead of boiling. This also is not shown to be impossible by any of the laws of physics. It is only shown to be highly improbable by the second law of the thermodynamics. This law states, speaking generally, that the universe tends towards democracy, and that when it has achieved that state, it will be incapable of doing anything more. It seems that the world has created at some not infinite remote date and was then far more of inequalities than it is now. But from the moment of creation, it has been continually running down and will ultimately stop for all practical purposes unless it is again wound up. Professor Eddington, for some reason, does not like the idea that it can be wound up again, but prefers to think that the world drama is only to be performed once, in spite of the fact that it must end in eons of boredom, in the course of which the whole audience will gradually go to sleep. Quantum theory, which is concerned with individual atoms and electrons, is still in a state of rapid development and is probably far from its final form. In the hands of Heisenberg, Schrödinger, and company, it has become more disturbing and more revolutionary than the theory of relativity ever was. Professor Eddington expounds its recent development in a matter which conveys more of it to the non-mathematical reader than I should ever suppose possible. It is profoundly disturbing in the prejudices which have governed physics since the time of Newton. The most painful thing about it from this point of view is that, as mentioned above, it throws doubt upon the universality of causality. The view at present is that perhaps atoms have a certain amount of free will, and that their behavior, even if theory, is not wholly suspect to law. Moreover, some things which we thought definite, at least in theory, have quite ceased to be so. There is what is called the principle of indeterminacy. This states that a particle may have position, or it may have velocity, but it cannot in any exact sense have both. That is to say that if you know where you are, you cannot tell how fast you are moving. and if you know how fast you are moving, you cannot tell where you are. This cuts at the root of traditional physics, in which position and velocity are fundamental. You can only see an electron when it emits light. And it only emits light when it jumps, so that to see where it was, you have to make it go elsewhere. This is interpreted by some writers as a breakdown of physical determinism, and it is utilized by Eddington in his concluding chapters to rehabilitate free will. Professor Eddington proceeds to base optimistic and pleasant conclusions upon the scientific nescience which he has expounded in previous pages. This optimism is based upon the time-honored principle that anything which cannot be proven untrue may be assumed to be true, a principle whose falsehood is proven by the fortunes of bookmakers. If we discard this principle, it is difficult to say that ground for cheerfulness modern physics provides. It tells us that the universe is running down, and if Eddington is right, it tells us practically nothing else, since all the rest of is merely rules of the game. As Sir Arthur himself has pointed out, in spite of evolution, which is introducing increasing organization into one little corner of the universe, there is, on the whole, a general loss of organization which will finally show up, the organization due to evolution. In the end, he says, the whole universe will reach a state of complete disorganization which will be the end of the world. At this stage, the universe will consist of a uniform mass at a uniform temperature. Nothing further will happen except that the universe will gradually swell. It speaks well for Sir Arthur's temperamental cheerfulness that he should find in this view a basis for optimism. Mark my break here. For another break, mark my page, mark my spot for another break. Need to get up and walk around for a minute or so. Let's see. I guess a couple of short songs. Be right back in about 5 minutes, everyone.
We gonna talk all over God.
Okay, and welcome back. I just remembered. I forgot, like I do sometimes. I don't have anything written out. I don't know if Roger, I think he might have his written out, but the little talk he goes through at the beginning about donating on a monthly basis. If somebody could donate to any of the stations on a monthly basis, and he could count on that kind of a money every month, $5 or $10, if she could get 10 or 20 people. Even people that don't listen on a regular basis, it would be deeply appreciated. From a pragmatic or political point of view, probably the most important thing about such a theory of physics is that it will destroy if it becomes widespread. That faith in science, which has been the only constructive creed of modern times and the source of practically all change, both for good and for evil. The 18th and 19th centuries had a philosophy of natural law based upon Newton. The law was supposed to imply a lawgiver through, as time went on, this inference was less emphasized. But in any case, the universe was orderly and predictable. By learning nature's laws, we could hope to manipulate nature, and thus science became the source of power. This is still the outlook of most energetic, practical men, but it is no longer the outlook of some among the men of science. The world, according to them, is a more higgledy-piggledy and haphazard affair than it was thought to be, and they know much less about it than was thought to be known by their predecessors in the 18th and 19th centuries. Perhaps the scientific skepticism of which Shackleton is an exponent may lead to the end of the collapse of the scientific era, just as a theoretical skepticism of the Renaissance has led gradually to the collapse of the theoretical era. I suppose that machines will survive the collapse of science, just as persons have survived the collapse of theology. But in the one case, as in the other, they will cease to be viewed with reverence and awe. What in these circumstances has science to contribute to metaphysics? Academic philosophers, ever since the time of Parmenides, have believed that the world is a unity. This view has been taken over from them by clergymen and journalists, and its acceptance has been considered the touchstone of wisdom. The most fundamental of my intellectual beliefs is that this is rubbish. I think the universe is all spots and jumps. Without unity, without continuity, without coherence or orderliness, or any of the other properties that govern this love. Instead, there is little but prejudice and habit to be said for the view that there is a world at all. Physicists have recently advanced opinions which, say, have led them to agree with the foregoing remarks. But they have been so pained by the conclusions of which logic would have them led them that they have been abandoning logic for theology in shoals. Every day some new physicist publishes a new pious volume to conceal from himself and others the fact that in this scientific capacity, he has plunged the world into unreason and unreality. To make an illustration, what are we to think of the sun? He used to be a glorious lump of heaven, a golden-haired god, a being to be worshipped by Zoroastrians and Aztecs and Incas. There is some reason to think that the doctrines of Zoroaster inspire Kepler's heliocentric cosmogony. But now the sun is nothing but waves of probability. If you ask what it is that is probable, or in what oceans the waves travel, the physicist, like the Mad Hatter, replies, "I have had enough of this. Suppose we change the subject." If, however, you press him, he will say that the waves are in his formulae, that his formulae are in his head, from which, however, you must not infer that the waves are in his head. To speak seriously, such orderliness as we appear to find in an external world is held by many to be due to their own passion for pigeonholes, and they maintain that it is quite doubtful whether they are such things as laws of nature. It is a curious sign of the times that religious apologists welcome this view. In the 18th century, they welcomed the reign of law, since they thought the laws implied a lawgiver. But religious apologists in the present day seem to be of the opinion that the world created by a deity must be irrational, on the ground apparently that they themselves have been made in God's image. The reconciliation of religion and science, which professors proclaim and bishops acclaim, rests in fact though subconsciously, on grounds of quite another sort, and might be set forth in the following practical syllogism. Science depends upon endowments, and endowments are threatened by Bolshevism. Therefore, science is threatened by Bolshevism. But religion is also threatened by Bolshevism. Therefore, religion and science are allies. No, not really. It follows, of course, that science, if pursued with sufficient profundity, reveals the existence of a god. Nothing so logical as this penetrates, however, to be a subconsciousness of the pious professors. The odd thing is that at the very moment when physics, which is the fundamental science, is undermining the whole structure of applied reason and presenting us with a world of unreal and fantastic dreams in place of a Newtonian order and solidity, applied science is becoming particularly useful and more able than ever to give results of value to human life. There is here a paradox, of which possibly the intellectual solution may be found thereafter, or usually possibly no solution may exist. The fact is that science plays two quite distinct roles. On the one hand, as a metaphysic, and on the other hand, as educated common sense. As a metaphysic, it has been undermined by its own success. Mathematical technique is now so powerful that it can find a formula for even the most erratic world. Plato and Sir James Jeans think that because geometry applies to the world, God must have made the world on a geometric pattern. But the mathematical logician suspects that God could have not made a world containing many things without exposing it to the skill of the geometer. In fact, the applicability of geometry to the physical world has ceased to be a fact about the world, about that world, and has become only a tribute to the geometer's cleverness. The only thing that the geometer needs is multiplicity, whereas the only thing the theologian needs is unity. Of unity, however vague, however tenuous, I see no evidence in modern science considering it as a metaphysic. But modern science considered as common sense remains triumphant, indeed more triumphant than ever before. In the view of this state of affairs, it is necessary to make a sharp distinction between metaphysical beliefs and practical beliefs in regard to the conduct of life. In metaphysics, my creed is short and simple. I think that the external world may be an illusion, but if it exists, it consists of events, short, small, and haphazard. Order, unity, and continuity are human inventions, just as truly as are catalogs and encyclopedias. But human inventions can, within limits, be made to prevail in our human world. And in the conduct of our daily life, we may, with advantage, forget the realm of chaos and only night, and old night by which we are perhaps surrounded. The ultimate metaphysical doubts which we have been considering have no bearing whatever upon the practical uses of science. If a Mendelian develops a variety of wheat which is immune from diseases that are destructive to the old varieties, if a physiologist makes a discovery about vitamins, if a chemist makes a discovery about the synthetic production of nitrates, the importance and usefulness of their work is quite independent to the question whether an atom consists of a miniature solar system, or a wave of probability, or an infinite rectangle of integers. When I speak of the importance of scientific method in regard to the conduct of human life, I am thinking of scientific method in its mundane forms. Not that I would undervalue science as a metaphysic, but that the value of science as metaphysics belongs in another sphere. It belongs with religion and art and love, and with the pursuit of the beatific vision, with the Promethean madness that leads the greatest men to strive to become gods. Perhaps the only ultimate value of human life is to be found in this Promethean madness. But it is a value that religious, not political, or even moral. It is this quasi-religious aspect of the value of science which appears to be succumbing to the assaults of skepticism. Until quite recently, men of science have felt themselves the high priests of a noble cult, namely the cult of truth, not truth as a religious sect understand it, i.e. as the battleground of a collection of dogmatists, but truth as a quest, a vision faintly appearing and again vanishing, a hope for sun to meet the Heraclitean fire. Heraclitean. H-E-R-A-C-L-I-T EAN. In the fire in the soul. It is because science was so conceived that men of science were willing to suffer privations and persecutions and to be execrated as enemies of established creeds. All this is fading into the past. The modern man of science, if of a timid disposition, knows he is respected and feels he does not deserve respect. He approaches the established older apologetically, more predecessors, he says, in effect, may have said harsh things about you because you were arrogant, and imagine that they possess some knowledge. I am more humble and do not claim to know anything that can be converted, that can convert your dogmas. In return, the established older showers knighthoods and fortunes upon such men of science, who become more and more determined supporters of the injustice and obscurantism upon which our social system is based. In the newer sciences such as psychology, this has not yet happened. There the old ardor still persists, and the old persecutions continue. Homer Lane, for example, who was at once a sage and a saint, was deported by the British police as an undesirable alien. But those newer sciences have not yet been touched by the cold breath of skepticism. The trouble is an intellectual one. Indeed, its solution, if there is one, is to be sought in logic. For my part, I have no solution to offer. Our age is one from increasingly substitutes power for the older ideals. And this is happening in science, as elsewhere. While science is the pursuit of power becomes increasingly triumphant, science as the pursuit of truth is being killed by skepticism, which the skill of men of science has generated. That this is a misfortune is undeniable, but I cannot admit that the substitution of superstition for skepticism, advocated by many of our leading men of science, would be an improvement. Skepticism may be painful and may be barren, but at least it is honest and an outcome of the quest for truth. Perhaps it is a temporary phase, but no real escape is possible by returning to the discarded beliefs of a stupider age. Chapter 5, Science and Religion. And I'm going to take a little 10-second break here to get something to drink. In recent times, the bulk of eminent physicists and the number of eminent biologists have made pronouncements stating that recent advances in science have disproved the older materialism and have tended to reestablish the truths of the religion. The statement of the scientists have, as a rule, been somewhat tentative and indefinite, but the theologians have seized upon them and extended them, while the newspapers in turn have reported the more sensational accounts of the theologians, so that the general public has derived the impression that physics confirms practically the whole of the book of Genesis. I do not myself think that the moral to be drawn from modern science is at all what the general public has thus been led to suppose. In the first place, the men of science have not said nearly as much as they are thought to have said. And in the second place, what they have said in the way of support of the traditional religious beliefs has been said. By them not in their cautious scientific capacity, but rather in their capacity of good citizens, anxious to defend virtue and property. The First World War and the Russian Revolution made all timid men conservative, and professors are usually temporarily timid. Such considerations, however, are beside the point. Let me examine what science really has to say. Number one, free will. Until very recent times, theology, while in its Catholic form, it admitted free will in human beings, showed an affection for natural law in the universe, tempered only by belief in occasional miracles. In the 18th century, under the influence of Newton, the alliance between theology and natural law became very close. It was held that God had created the world in accordance with a plan, and that natural laws were the embodiment of this plan. Until the 19th century, theology remained hard and intellectual and definite. In order to meet the assaults of atheistic reason, however, it has, during the last 100 years, aimed more and more appealing to sentiment. It has tried to catch men in their intellectually relaxed moods, and from having been a straitjacket, it has become a dressing gown. In our day, only the fundamentalists and a few of the more learned Catholic theologians maintain the old respectable intellectual tradition. All the other religious apologists have engaged in blunting the edge of logic, appealing to the heart instead of the head, maintaining that our feelings can demonstrate the falsity of a conclusion in which one reason has been driven. As Lord Tennyson nobly says, "And like a man in wrath, the heart stood up and answered, 'I have felt.'" In our day, the heart has feelings about atoms, about the respiratory system, about the growth of sea urchins, and other such topics concerning which, but for science, it would remain indifferent. One of the most remarkable developments in religious apologists in recent times is the attempt to rescue free will in man by means of ignorance as to the behavior of atoms. The older laws of mechanics which governed the movements of bodies, large enough to be seen among true, to be a very close approximation as regards such bodies, but are found to be not applicable to single atoms, still less to single electrons and protons. It is not yet known with any certainty whether there are laws governing the behavior of single atoms in all respects, or whether the behavior of such atoms is in part random. It is thought possible that the laws governing the behavior of large bodies may be merely statistical laws expressing the average results of large number of random motions. Some, such as the second law of thermodynamics, are known to be statistical laws, and it is possible that others may be. In the atom, where there are various possible states which do not merge continuously into each other, but are separated by small, finite gaps, the atom may hop from one of these states to another, And there are various different hops that it may make. At present, no laws are known to decide which of the possible hops will take place in any given occasion. And it is suggested that the atom is not subject to laws at all in this respect, but has what might be called analogy, free will. Eddington, in his book on the nature of the physical world, has made great play with this possibility. I marked my spot right here. Seems to be a quick going show. Zipping right along. So, I'm going to take the last break. About 6 minutes, everyone. Be right back.
Well, I once was lost in sin, but Jesus took me in.
Little talk with my Jesus, Lord, it makes it all right.
Okay, and welcome back. I have a funny little story. I don't remember when George Burns died. It was somewhere, I don't know, what was it, 2004 or 2005? Maybe somebody can look it up, but I seen a special. It was about his life. I think George Burns ended up, when did he end up being 103 or 104, somewhere in there? Maybe somebody can look it up for me, but there was a special about him when he was about 96 years old, so this would have put him probably in the mid-90s somewhere. he was walking through a park, and another older gentleman had come up to him and started talking to him about, he said he seen him in, what was it, vaudeville or something, or some sort of a play on vaudeville, maybe. This was, he said, in the 1930s, mid-1930s or early 1930s or something like that. And George looked at the other old guy and he said, "Well, how old are you?" And he said, "I'm 86, sir." And he said, "Oh, you're just a kid. Go get me a glass of milk, son." It was just a big chuckle. I liked it. It was a good story. He thinks, apparently, that the mind can decide the atoms of in the brain to make one or another of the possible transitions that at a given moment, and thus by means of some kind of trigger action, produce large-scale results in accordance with its volition. The volition itself, he thinks, is uncaused. If he is right, the course of the physical world, even where fairly large masses are concerned, is not completely predetermined by physical law, but is liable to be altered by the uncaused volitions of human beings. Oh, he just made 100. Okay. Well, I'm not sure when that... I know he was still alive, so it must have been somewhat earlier than that. Early 90s. Going on 30 years ago. Yes, it was a nice story. I liked it. Before examining this position, I should like to say a few words about what is called the principle of indeterminacy. This principle was introduced into physics in 1927 by Heisenberg and has been seized on by clergymen, chiefly, I think, on account of its name. as something capable of giving them an escape from thraldom to mathematical laws. It is, to my mind, somewhat surprising that Eddleton should countenance this use of the principle of intermittency states that it is possible to determine what precision both the position and the momentum of a particle. Yes, I think it was in, well, I remember him saying that he was 96, so it was just 4 years before that, Mom. So thank you, though, for looking that up. There will be a margin of error in each, and the product of the two errors is constant. That is to say, the more accurately we determine the one, the less accurately we shall be determining the other, and vice versa. The margin of error involved is, of course, very small. I am surprised, I repeat, that Eddington should have appealed to this principle in connection to the question of free will, for the principle does nothing whatever to show that the course of nature is not determined. It shows merely that the old space-time apparatus is not quite adequate to the needs of modern physics, which in any case is known on other grounds. Space and time were invented by the Greeks. Space and time were invented by the Greeks and served their purpose admirably until the present century. Einstein replaced them by a kind of centaur, which he called space-time. And this did well enough for a couple of decades, but modern quantum mechanics has made it evident that a more fundamental reconstruction is necessary. The principle of indeterminacy is merely an illustration of its necessity, not of the failure of physical laws to determine the course of nature. As J.E. Turner has pointed out, Nature, December 27, 1930, the use of which the principle of indeterminacy has been put is largely due to an ambiguity of the word determined. In one sense, a quantity is determined when it is measured. In the other sense, an event is determined when it is caused. The principle of indeterminacy has to do with measurement, not with causation. The velocity and position of a particle are declared by the principle to be undetermined in the sense that they cannot be accurately measured. This is a physical fact causally connected with the fact that the measuring of a physical process, which has a physical effect upon what is measured. There is nothing whatever in the principle of indeterminacy to show that any physical event is uncaused. As Turner says, every argument that since some change cannot be determined in the sense of ascertained, it is therefore not determined in the absolutely different sense of caused, is a fallacy of equivocation. More gobbledygook. Returning now to the atom and its supposed free will, it should be observed that it is not known that the behavior of the atom is capricious. It is false to say that the behavior of the atom is known to be capricious. It is also false to say that the behavior is known to be not capricious. Science has quite recently discovered that the atom is not subject to the laws of the older physics, and some physicists have somewhat rashly jumped to the conclusion that the atom is not subject to the laws at all. Eddington's argument about the effect of the mind on the brain inevitably reminds one of Descartes' argument on the same subject. Descartes knew of the conservation of the vis a vis, but not of the conservation of momentum. He therefore thought that the mind could alter the direction of the motion of the animal spirits, although not its amount. When, shortly after the publications of his theory, the conservation of momentum was discovered, Descartes' view had to be abandoned. Eddington's view, similarly, is at the mercy of the experimental physicist, who may at any moment discover laws regulating the behavior of individual atoms. It is very harsh to erect a theological superstructure upon a piece of ignorance which may be only momentary, and the effects of this procedure, so far as it has any, are necessarily bad, since they make men hope, and new discoveries will not be made. There is, moreover, a purely empirical objection to the belief in free will. However, it has been possible to subject the behavior of animals or of human beings to careful scientific observation. It has been found, as in Pavlov's experiments, that scientific laws are just as discoverable as in any other sphere. It is true that we cannot predict human actions with any completeness, but this is quite sufficiently accounted for by the complication of the mechanism, and by no means demands the hypothesis of complete lawlessness, which is found to be false wherever it can be carefully tested. Those who desire caprice in the physical world seem to me to have failed to realize what this would involve. All inference in regard to the course of nature is casual, and if nature is not subject to casual laws, such inference must fail. We cannot in that case know anything outside our personal experience. Indeed, strictly speaking, we can only know our experience in the present moment, since all memory depends upon casual laws. If we cannot infer the existence of other people, or even of our own past, how much less can we infer God or anything else that the theologians desire? The principle of causality may be true or may be false, but the person who finds the hypothesis of its falsity cheering is failing to recognize the implications of his own theory. He usually retains unchallenged. He usually retains unchallenged all those casual laws which he finds convenient. As, for example, that his food will nourish him, and that his bank will honor his checks as long as his amount is in funds, while rejecting all those that he finds inconvenient. This, however, is altogether too naive a procedure. There is, in fact, no good reason whatever for supposing that the behavior of atoms is not subject to law. It is only quite recently that experimental methods have been able to throw any light on the behavior of individual atoms. And it is no wonder if the laws of his behavior have not yet been discovered. To prove that a given set of phenomena is not subject to laws is essentially and theoretically impossible. All that can be affirmed is that the laws, if any, have not yet been discovered. We may say, if we choose, that the men who have been investigating the atom are so clever that they must have discovered the laws, if there were any. I do not think, however, that this is a sufficiently solid premise upon which to base a theory of the universe. Number 2. God as mathematician. Sir Arthur Eddington deduces religion from the fact that atoms do not obey the laws of mathematics. Sir James Jeans deduces it from the fact that they do. Both these arguments have been accepted with equal enthusiasm by the theologians, who hold, apparently, that the demand for consistency belongs to the cold reason that, and must not interfere with our deeper religious feelings. We have examined Eddington's argument from the way that atoms jump. Let us now examine Jeans' argument from the way that stars cool. Jeans' God is Platonic. He is not, we are told, a biologist or an engineer, but a pure mathematician. The Mysterious Universe, page 134. I confess to the preference that this type of God, rather than the one that is conceived after the analogy of big business, but that no doubt is because I prefer thinking to doing. This suggests a treatise, dealing with the influence of muscular tone upon theology. The man whose muscles are taut believes in God of action, while the man whose muscles are relaxed believes in the God of thought and contemplation. Sir James Jean, confident, no doubt, in his own theistic arguments, is not very complimentary to those of the evolutionist. His book on the mysterious universe begins with a biography of the sun. One might almost say an epitaph. It seems to not more than one star in about 100,000 has planets. But that some 2,000 million years ago, the sun had the good fortune to make a fruitful meeting with another star, which led to the existing planetary offspring. The stars that do not have planets cannot rise to life, so that life must be a very rare phenomenon in the universe. It seems incredible. Says Sir James, the universe can have been designed primarily to produce life like our own. Had it been so, surely we might have expected to find a better proportion between the magnitude of the mechanism and the amount of the product. And even in the rare corner of the universe, and possibly of life, exists only during an interlude between the weather. It is too hot, and whether it is too cold. It is a tragedy of our own race that it is probably destined to die of cold, while the greater part of the substance of the universe still remains too hot for life to obtain a footing. Theologians who argue as if human life were the purpose of creation seems to be as faulty in their astronomy as they are excessive in their estimation of themselves and their fellow creatures. I shall not attempt to summarize Jean's admirable chapters on modern physics, matter and radiation and relativity, and the ether. They are already as brief as possible, and no summary can do them justice. I will, however, quote Professor Jean's own summary in order to whet the reader's appetite. To sum up, a soap bubble with irregularities and corrugations on his surface is perhaps the best representation in terms of simple and familiar materials of the new universe revealed to us by the theory of relativity. The universe is not a interior of a soap bubble, but its surface, and we must always remember that. While the surface of the soap bubble has only two dimensions, the universal bubble has four, three dimensions of space and one of time. And the substance out there, out of which this bubble is blown, the soap film, is empty space wielded on the empty time. The last chapter of the book is concerned to argue that this soap bubble has been blown by the mathematical deity because of his interest in its mathematical properties. This part has pleased the theologians. Theologians have grown grateful for small mercies, and they do not much care for what sort of God a man of science gives them so long as he gives them one at all. Sir James Jean's God, like Plato's, is one who has a passion for doing sums, but being a pure mathematician is quite indifferent as to what the sums are about. By prefacing his argument by a lot of difficult and recent physics, the eminent author manages to give it an air of profundity, which it would not otherwise possess. In essence, the argument is as follows. Since two apples and two apples together make four apples, it follows that the Creator must have known that two and two are four. It might be objective that since one man and one woman together sometimes make three, the Creator was not yet quite as well versed in sums as one could wish. To speak seriously, Sir James Jeans reverts explicitly to the theory of Bishop Berkeley, according to which the only thing that exists are thoughts, and the quasi-performance which we observe in the external world is due to the fact that God keeps on thinking about things for quite a for quite a long time. Material objects, for example, do not cease to exist when no human being is looking at them, because God is looking at them all the time, or rather because they are thoughts in his mind as at all times. The universe, he says, can be best pictured, although still imperfectly and inadequately, as consisting of pure thought. The thought of what, for want of a wider word, we must describe as a mathematical thinker. A little later, we are told that the laws governing God's thoughts are those which govern the phenomena of our waking hours, but not, apparently, of our dreams. I'm going to stop right there for the day. I need a little bit of dinner. It's dinner time, everyone, so let's see. Just a 4-minute song to end. Well, actually, I'm not even going to end with a song. Just going to drop the streams, Annie, so you can pick it up. I hope to see everybody tomorrow. That's me and Roger.